everyone. It's Kyle here, and I got to say it's an honor to welcome everybody to the first episode of our newest show, Couch Potato Theater. We're going to have a lot of fun with this show as we move forward with it. The idea of Couch Potato is to take a movie that we all know as fans, but maybe it didn't do quite so well in the box office. You know, possibly something like The Last Starfighter, Krull, you know, cult classic movies that we all enjoy. But, you know, for what one reason or another, it just didn't work for those. But for our first episode, we're doing something incredibly special, and it's close to my heart. Earlier in the year, you heard Kevin and Norman do a Highlander commentary for the 30th anniversary of Highlander. Well, it happens to be that this is the 30th anniversary for another fandom classic, and that is the original Transformers the movie, the original animated feature. Now, this was a very big movie for me growing up, and I remember seeing it in the movie theater, and to be doing this now is amazing. And I've got a couple very special guests here with me to do this. First of all, I want to introduce the man who is the newest member of the Fandom Podcast Network, and that is Mr. Davis Grayson. Davis, how are you doing, my friend?
Ba weep, grana weep, ninny bond.
I have Energon goodies.
It is great. It's a good night, and it feels good to be welcomed aboard.
Well, we are glad to have you, and Davis is not the only one here, because I'd also like to welcome to this podcast Mr. John Mills. John, how are you doing?
The verdict is innocent.
No! This not this mockery of justice.
Oh my gosh, to go through. Yeah, we'll get to that. Like, what bad luck do you have to get away from Unicron and then end up there? Come on, man. Who did you piss off?
Yeah, you want to talk about bad luck. I think Kranix had absolutely the worst luck ever.
Hands down.
So, fellas, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourselves and, you know, what are the things you're doing right now so they know that where they can find you, because by the end of this, they're not going to want to listen to me anymore.
Well, John, you want to go first?
Sure. Okay. Well, you can find me crawling around on the internet at Kessel Junkie. That's my username just about anywhere. Twitter's where you'll usually find me hanging out. I'm over on the Trek FM network. I co-host a show called Stage 9, which is a podcast examining the works of Star Trek creators when they're not creating Star Trek. And I'm on a podcast on the Nerd Party network called Aggressive Negotiations, which is a different kind of Star Wars podcast that explores the more esoteric corners of that galaxy far, far away. But I am thrilled to be here because this is hands down one of my favorite movies of all time. So, Davis, what are you up to, man? Where can they find you?
Well, normally you will be able to find me also on Twitter at Davis Grayson as well. And I am one of the associate producers for the 602 Club on Trek.fm. When we actually have a Facebook group called the Babel Conference. So you can find me in there lurking about every now and then. But the 602 Club is basically talking about all things geekery that doesn't always pertain to Star Trek. So it's a lot of fun to listen to and everything. And right now I am one of the newest members of the Fandom Network, and you'll see me posting a few tidbits of toy collectibles and whatnot, especially the new upcoming SDCC collectibles and whatnot. I was just gonna say I'm very excited to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and we, as the classic X-Men line goes, we hope you survive the experience, Davis. So let's talk a little bit about Transformers here. I got a little bit of history of the film. Film came out in 1986. Grossed a little over $5 million at the box office for the time. The exact number was 5,849,647. So
not much by any measure.
No,
box office.
And I think it was the 99th film grossing film of the year.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Well, so. I mean, the thing is, what's easy to forget though is that 5 million at the box office for like a niche movie like this back in 1986 dollars was okay. It wasn't a disaster. Like nowadays, you'd hear a movie made $5 million at the box office, and you would think it's The Room by Tommy Wiseau. But like, you know, the movie landscape was a lot different back in 1986. You know, you didn't have a big blockbuster every single week the way that you do in 2016. So they weren't expecting to make, you know, a contemporary movie. They weren't expecting to make Top Gun money when it came out. And even Top Gun by today's standards made virtually nothing. And so it's, you know, I think that 5 million and change for what this movie is, yeah, that's not a success, but at the same time, it's not a disaster the way that we would view it now, you know?
Oh, I agree. And what we've got to consider at this time was, I mean, we're talking about an 80s cartoon, which even more so than any other time, it was one big toy commercial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And especially with this film, which we will get into a little later, but this film and the G.I. Joe movie that came out after it basically set up a whole new line of toys and really for Transformers, almost a complete change of direction from where it had been.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
But before we start getting into things that take place after the film, guys, let's talk a little bit about Transformers before this movie came out. Now, I don't know about you guys, but my Transformers love started very early. I got some of the classic original figures. I was reading the Marvel comic that was coming out at the time. And then I remember the Family Home Entertainment started putting out Transformers cartoons on VHS. And I got to tell you, they were the hardest things to find to rent for about a year because they were constantly checked out.
I was into Transformers from the get-go. I remember what an insane rage they were to get, and how one of my Christmas gifts, I remember specifically getting Soundwave for a Christmas gift. And just thinking it was like I just about exploded out of my skin because I thought it was just the greatest thing ever because Soundwave was really cool. And, you know, I mean, he had tapes that came out. Come on, man. You know, Avage and, you know, but and Laserbeak. But yeah, you know, like the show was if I were to pick two cartoons from my childhood that were really formative in you know, helping direct what I was going to like later in my life or as I was growing up, it would be Transformers and Robotech. Like those were the shows. I watched G.I. Joe. I love G.I. Joe as well, but Transformers and Robotech, the idea of transforming machinery to me as a kid was the greatest idea that anybody had ever come up with.
Oh, I so agree. I think my first real exposure to giant robots was, I want to say it was early 80s when on cable, I don't know if you guys are big anime fans, but there was a series of five animes that were brought over to the U.S. and they called it Force 5. And it was Spacketeers, Guy King, Dangard Ace, Grandizer, and Starvengers. And that's where I kind of got hooked into the whole giant robot thing. And then Voltron came along and Transformers and Robotech and all those shows. In fact, for those of you listening, we are currently doing one of our other shows, The Phantom Flashback. We are doing Robotech right now. But it's so funny you bring up Robotech because of the fun little history of Robotech tied in with one of the greatest Transformer toys that they ever made.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
and probably, honestly, it's definitely in my top three of Transformer toys ever, and that we're talking about the Jetfire figure.
Or Skyfire, if you're going by the show.
Well, you know, there was the whole legal logistics there.
Yep. Did it annoy anybody else that Skyfire, like the whole name change and the slight like visual difference used to drive me up the wall. I was like, why don't they just use Jetfire, man? Come on. I'm a kid. I don't understand copyright.
And slight visual difference? Are we really calling going slight?
I was being generous.
Well, you know, I don't know if y'all have noticed this, but the generation line for Hasbro, they actually released an updated Jetfire, and he looks pretty sharp. I mean,
yeah, I've seen it. It looks kind of like what the design they've given him in the current IDW comics.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you guys this then. What was your, as if you can recall, what was your first Transformer toy?
My first one. Let's see. You know, it's funny. I got a Decepticon first and then an Autobot. And my first Decepticon was Starscream. Starscream and Skywarp. Because it was birthday money. And then I had got, I believe it was Bumblebee from that point. And then, of course, I've gotten a few more over the years.
Oh, wow. My very first one. I mean, obviously, Soundwave made an impression. I remember getting an off-market imitation Shockwave that I adored. I treasured that thing. But I knew it wasn't licensed. I knew it was a knockoff. But come on. You know, a boy's got a dream. It couldn't have been Soundwave. I think that my first one was a smaller one, and I think it was Cliffjumper. But I think also that did anybody else encounter the unique training in how to be polite when, say, a grandparent would? My grandparents were in New York, and they would go to Duane Reade. And every so often they would come down and they would get me a special, hey, here's one of those robots you like. And it was a GoBot, like Coptor. And it was like, oh, thank you, Grammy. This was very thoughtful of you. And like in the back of your mind, you're like, cannot let on that this is not cool. Cannot let on that I wanted Transformers.
It's funny that you bring this up because I remember as a kid, you never had enough Transformers. It always feels like I need more.
Yeah.
And if you remember, there was a larger GoBot line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had actually gotten a few of those as gifts, and somehow they magically merged into my Transformer Wars. Because some of those larger GoBots actually were like, okay, these aren't too bad of figures, but still. Now, for me, as far as the first Transformer I ever owned, that's real easy. It was Ironhide.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Now, I love Ironhide, but oh my God, was the toy horrible to play with?
That was all, you know. The toys were always a different experience than the show would lead you to believe, weren't they?
Especially when you're talking about Ironhide and Ratchet.
Uh-huh,
oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. I mean, I'm like, when the show came out, I'm like, that's not Ironhide. Ironhide is two pieces, and he's kind of funky looking, and. But
well, I mean, I know with Ironhide, actually, it's, I think that's that first whole line. They were called in Japan the Diaclones.
Yeah, Diaclones,
and they had pilots.
Yeah, they all had pilots. So that's actually where everything originated from. Now, the first Decepticon I ever owned was Soundwave.
Nice.
So love that. Now, okay, going forward, let me ask you guys this. What was your what do you feel was your greatest achievement as I own this particular Transformer?
Oh, my gosh, I can't remember his name. I hate getting older, but I can't remember his name. But it was there was a Transformer he was, I remember specifically, it was like $60 or something, because I won't go into how I got the money. Nothing illicit. Don't worry. No, nothing I should have been jailed for, but you know, maybe there was some skimming off of a parent's open closet. I don't know.
Oh,
I can't
my.
Confirm or deny these. Hey, you know, it takes a long time to get to $60, though, okay?
That $2 a week allowance.
Yeah, I would have been a really good accountant because I got real good at skimming. And or somebody did. Not me. But he changed six different things. He was like a giant thing. I can't remember his name.
Six Shot.
Yes, there you go.
Six Shot, yes, who to this day is still considered the hardest transformer to transform.
Yes.
It's like you're like considered a transformer expert if you can get him to transform into all six modes.
Yeah, and I remember how I don't want to say disappointing, but the whole thing, like I over time would stop playing with him because he bore that taint of dishonesty. And so I couldn't go near him after a time. I was like, I don't deserve you. And he would sit there and say, play with me a little bit. I was like, no, I can't.
Well, on the exact opposite spectrum of this, my I have to say, when I was in school, we had I went to a private school. And so if you didn't get detention for like the entire year, anything like that, my parents would always say, we would give you something, you know, as a just reward. So, you know, stay out of trouble, John. But, you know.
Statute of limitations has run out, man. Come on.
But how I got it was, I don't know if anyone remembers this department store. It was called Zayers.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually bought, with the money that I earned, Metroplex.
I owned Metroplex.
Nice.
One of the greatest toys ever.
I mean, it was a city, and it was one of the coolest things. And, you know, I actually have the Generations updated one. Haven't opened him yet, but I have him.
Yeah, that's a nice piece. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, for me, this gets a little complicated because there were so many I enjoyed. But I think it kind of comes into, it's almost a three-way tie. I had Jetfire. And to this day, that is one of my biggest regrets when I moved, that I had to get rid of a lot of my classic toys because shipping everything from Alaska was just unrealistic to pay for. I wish I would have kept that damn Jetfire.
Yeah.
But I think the other one, as far as just when you're talking pure accomplishment, was when I finally got the last of the Constructicons and I could form Devastator.
I never had the ones that would go together. That had to be such a special day. You know, like you could finally do it. You could finally make the monster.
Yeah. And then the monster could not stand to save his life. But but then I think really it stands out. The day, living in Alaska, we had a department store called Fred Meyer's. And I'm walking through it with my dad one day, and I look up, and there is Optimus Prime.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
And it took much begging and many chores for many weeks thereafterwards, but I convinced my dad to buy me Optimus Prime. And I think about that time, Optimus was about a $25 figure.
Oh, yeah.
So, now, for me, too, the other thing, and I'll ask you both you guys here in a second. There's the Transformers that got away, the ones you always wanted, but you just could never find in the store, never come across. And for me, there was two. I owned two of the five Dinobots, and it always killed me that I never had all five Dinobots. But the other thing that always killed me is I never, ever owned the Aerial Bots.
Oh.
Oh, oh wow. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. The Aerial Bots.
I had Omega Supreme, which was one of the cooler toys with its mechanisms in it. But, yeah, I remember when the Aerial Bots and the Stunticons came out because you could buy them individually, but that's also when they started making the limited edition collector sets where you got all of them in one collector set, and I believe those ran for like $50 at the time.
Yeah.
And they had that in one of the grocery stores, and I begged and I pleaded, but there was just no way it was happening. And and to this day, I think that's the one of those toys that's like, that's the one thing I wish I would have owned as a kid.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You know, I would say that for me, it would have been a complete set of Insecticons.
I had those.
Man. I only had two of them. I had the grasshopper and the scarab beetle.
You had shrapnel and kickback.
Yes, shrapnel and kickback, and I always wanted more because I always thought that the Insecticons of all, especially of all of the you know, form a giant robot ones, like I loved the Insecticons. They were fascinating to me. I love the color. I love the way they were put together. I love the way that they functioned when they were both in their you know, their insect mode and their robot mode. I thought they looked cool. I thought they were cool. I always wanted to complete that set, never did. And now I think I have to go to eBay, now that we're talking about it, and see if I can afford to complete a childhood dream.
This could be the most expensive podcast ever.
Yeah.
Actually, John, I'm looking right now. The Generations line actually released. They're like $9.99 a piece, but Shrapnel is out.
Sold.
And so is Bombshell.
Sold. And, yes.
And then remember the second set of Insecticons? Like Chop Shop.
Yeah. They were so bad.
Yeah. They're starting to release them as well and gave them like different origins and everything. Chop Shop, I think he's like a master thief. I mean, it's just really cool. But I mean, you just have like a different Decepticon to be able to use and everything. So
now, when you guys were kids, did you guys ever get any of the mail-in Transformers?
Is that like the Omnibots?
You had the Omnibots, and they also if you remember going back to especially season one of Transformers, you had the Reflector character, which was the three Decepticons that merged into a camera.
Oh yeah, I remember my cousin had Reflector. Yeah,
And that was another one. I wish I would have gotten that one. But of all the Transformers that came out, I think the one that I still to this day don't believe actually ever existed was the original Trypticon, because I have never seen one of those in person.
Oh, Trypticon. Oh, yeah. Oh, man. See, the thing is, I not Trypticon in specific, but you just reminded me, I lived vicariously through my cousin's Transformers collection. Because he would get a lot of, and I think that's what spurred me on to get Six Shot, was he would always get these awesome ones. And jealousy is a very powerful, powerful driving factor. But he would always have the super cool ones. And I would sit, like, I'd go over and I'd play with him, and I'd just sit there. I'd be like, man, I deserve these more than he does. I would treat these so much better. And it just, oh, so you've just taken me down that whole memory lane of, you know, like, because his whole collection was basically like a showcase of things that I couldn't have that I wanted so bad.
Yeah, no, I had a friend like that. He wasn't a huge fan of Transformers but then one summer he went on vacation for the summer, came back and had like this insane Transformers collection. I mean. Ugh. He had all three of the original planes. He had the second wave of planes. He had all of Soundwave's cassettes.
Come on.
I'm like, I hate you. And he probably played with them for another month and then just lost interest in Transformers. And I'm like, just give them to me. I will give them a good home.
Yes. Yeah. Give it to somebody who would love them and treat them right.
and cradle you and love you and squeeze you and
exactly. Yep.
So then we've talked about the toys. Now, obviously we've all watched the original series. Did you guys read the Marvel comic at all?
Religiously.
Indeed.
Every month.
What was your first issue?
Oh, first issue of the miniseries.
Really?
Yeah.
My first issue, and it was the most, I can remember going into a pharmacy with my grandfather. He was getting some medicine. He let me pick out the comic book, and I picked it up. It was Transformers number 3.
And if Spider-Man.
Do you remember what it was? 3 of the ongoing series, but do you remember what it says on the very front cover of that?
No, it's been a while. But no, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
It actually has Shockwave on the front cover, and he just put on the wall, "Are all dead."
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that was.
Oh my gosh, was that issue 3?
No, that was issue. I thought that was issue four. No, that was issue 5.
5.
Oh, 5. I'm sorry. 5.
Issue 3 was Spider-Man. They put Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
And that's when Spider-Man had just gotten that black costume.
Oh my gosh, that's right.
Yes, that is right.
Oh.
Because
issue
4 was the big final battle between the original Decepticons and the Autobots, and they beat the living hell out of each other, and at the end of the issue, there's a big explosion. Everybody's taken out, and here comes Shockwave.
That's right. That's right. And I remember the end of that issue and seeing that. I was like, what is happening?
And then it was
such a great twist.
And it was like 6 months before issue 5 came out, and they started the regular monthly series.
Yep. And the artist changed too. I think because wasn't it Herb Trimpe? Didn't Herb Trimpe take over regular art duties?
Yes,
around that time.
Because he also did some
G.I. Joe comic. Yeah,
and he did Wolverine as well.
Yeah.
Oh, now, yeah. No, I didn't like his run on Wolverine at all.
Now,
his style was definitely tailored more toward the G.I. Joe Transformers lines. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, here's a fun one for you. Go back and read that first issue, and all of the Transformers look exactly like the toy.
Yes, they do.
And it's about issue 3, 4, and 5 that they started morphing into what they look like on the cartoon show.
Yeah, speaking of morphing, do you remember later on in that series, they reprinted the issues number 1 and 2, at least, maybe more of the Great Britain version?
Mm. Simon Fuhrer was his name?
Fuhrman?
Fuhrman, who to this day is considered the like grand poobah of Transformers comic book writers. Because his run was just so remarkable.
Have you ever noticed?
Okay, somebody talk.
I thought we dropped off. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, I thought that too.
Go on, Davis. Go on.
I was just going to say, did anyone else notice, though, in that first issue of Transformers, how much of a continuity Marvel had in the 80s?
Oh,
because if you look at it, it meant basically the Transformers were in the Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And when they brought in Death's Head, who is actually a bounty hunter going after one of the Transformers, he was shrunk down to human size by the Doctor.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Now, one of the things, too, I remember about the original series was the fact, and it was a little later in the run, when probably starting in the teens, how big of a player they made Blaster in the original series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Gosh, yeah. No, now that you said it, yes. To get back to the comics, like the difference between the show and the comics, you know, that like Transformers comics and the show were always sort of like almost like a multiverse version. You know, it's almost like the Star Trek Kelvin timeline versus original timeline for Star Trek, like both can coexist. And I think it's a testament to the fans that they could sort of like let those sort of things slide. because we understood that it was like, okay, this is the comic series and okay, this is the TV series. And so, you know, things like different emphases on characters were totally cool with us. We didn't care because we were getting what we loved.
Yeah, absolutely.
No. One of the things I find interesting too with the comics is how much the comics have evolved to where they are at their current state with IDW. Do either of you guys remember the run that the comic book company Dreamwave did?
Yes.
Where you had Pat Lee doing the art, and it, to me, that's still the best Transformers art we've ever seen.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it had a unique story which explained right before this movie.
Yeah.
Like why we didn't see certain things or certain elements, and it did explain some things.
Yeah, it even kind of gave a lot of explanation of where all these new characters came from.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and then I look at what IDW is doing now, and I'm a little up and down about it, but they've created such a rich universe out of all of this. At times, it's almost a little hard to follow, but they're doing a pretty solid job.
Well, I think, you know, I think that IDW is capitalizing on something that like comic fans do and don't want to admit about themselves, which is that the target audience has matured or at least gotten older in such a way that they're able to bring different resources to bear. I like what I admire about IDW is it's sort of they're the comic company that approaches it, I would say, in the WWE era of pro wrestling versus the 1980s WWF era of pro wrestling, where they're very aware of what their audience wants and will tolerate and will enjoy and will speak directly to it instead of trying to do that sort of complex song and dance that, say, DC is doing right now, where it's like, well, you know, we've matured and we're doing so, like IDW is like, you're buying Transformers because you loved them growing up, and here are some great storylines for you to read. I mean, at least that's the way I take it.
Yeah, no,
absolutely. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
To that point, and it's just getting a little off of Transformers, but because IDW is about to do something very interesting. Are you guys aware of what IDW has planned?
The HCU.
Yep. Which, on one hand, I'm very excited about, because if it's going to bring Mask back, I'm all for it, because I'm down for new recreations of Mask toys.
All about it. Oh, man. Yeah. You know, Mask was a great, I mean, honestly, I think Mask is sort of one of those things that's an offshoot of Transformers in the sense that, you know, it capitalizes on the whole love of transforming machinery that powered the Transformers thing. And it's like, well, here's transforming machinery, but yeah, now there are people that drive it. So here you go. Here's your motorcycle sidecar that goes into the water and is a submarine. Okay. I'm down with that.
Yeah. Well, I always considered Mask like that hidden fourth greatest toy line of the 80s, just behind G.I. Joe, Transformers, and Masters of the Universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I loved it when Hasbro actually released a Matt Tracker figure for the 25th anniversary line. And it talked about they were a sub-team of the Joes, and Venom was a sub-team of Cobra. I mean, I really wanted a Miles Mayhem figure, and hopefully, we might get one. I mean, I know we talked about with the Hasbro Cinematic Universe. I was tweeting the other day with Andrew Griffiths, who's one of the artists on More Than Meets the Eye, and not More Than Meets the Eye, but Transformers, just the regular comic, and yeah, a couple other ones he's done. And he actually, I started talking to him when he actually suggested it, but he talked about the Visionaries.
Oh, yes. And I remember
the Visionaries. They're supposed to be tied in together, well, too.
Yes, I remember Visionaries quite well. In fact, if I remember correctly, I had pretty much all of the figures. I just didn't have any of the vehicles.
Nice.
So, well, gentlemen, I think we've kind of been down memory lane here. One last kind of topic I want to hit is, since we're about to do Transformers the movie commentary, what are your thoughts of the show going into the point where they lead into the movie?
Oh man, I was a devoted watcher. When I found out that there was going to be a Transformers movie, you know, that was a wonderful thing. But it's so tough because, you know, you can go back and you can revisit the shows and you can recognize where nostalgia is informing your opinion of this or that, or, you know, oh, this was cooler or less cool when I was a kid. And, oh, I see what they did there. But my distinct memory of Transformers, the show, going into the movie was just adoring it. Like, it was just the greatest thing. Like, I loved everything about it. I wouldn't miss an episode. I would watch any repeat that they put on the air. I was an absolutely hardcore devoted fan of the Transformers show going into the movie.
Oh, yeah, because I never forget, the movie came out in June, and my birthday is in May. And I remember my mom and dad bought for me a new Transformer for the movie. I don't know how it came out before then or whatever, but it was Rodimus Prime. And seeing Rodimus Prime, and it looked like he was a future Winnebago or RV or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm going, who is Rodimus Prime? And it made me really excited for this movie and everything. So,
you know, I'm glad you mentioned your birthday, because I saw it for my birthday that year as well. My birthday's in August. But if you think about that, nowadays for a movie to run, you know, 2 months, it has to be like The Force Awakens. It has to be a $2 billion global sensation.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas this movie, and I think this speaks as well to box office expectations, this movie makes less than $6 million back then, but a young man in a podunk little town travels an extra distance to go to an actual movie theater because his hometown didn't have one. And 2 months later, it's still playing there in one of its, it was 5 screens, right? Like, I think that's an important thing to highlight, is this movie had a decent run, even though it didn't make what we would consider gangbusters box office.
Yeah. I was very similar for me. I saw it for my birthday. Now it was a few days beforehand, but my birthday, obviously at the time of this recording, has about 20 minutes left in July 8th. But I saw this for my birthday, but yeah, Transformers movie lasted through the summer in most box offices. And that just doesn't, a movie like that, if we're lucky, we get 3 weeks out of it in today's movie world. So,
oh yeah.
Now guys, when was the first time you learned about the film? Because for me, it was when they started advertising it at the end of Transformers episodes.
I would have to say that's probably about the same amount of time. And I remember the movie had a different rating on it. It was like PG. And I remember someone saying that there's swear words in it or something like that. My parents were a little hesitant at first. I couldn't go by myself, so my dad went with me. I remember that.
Well, I'll hit you guys with an interesting thing. Why Transformers, the movie, was rated PG. They put the one infamous swear word in Transformers, the movie, to get it the PG rating. Because being a PG-rated movie, it allowed them to show it in more theater screens than a G-rated movie would be at the time. They could show it later at night.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's so funny that Hollywood likes to appeal to the family audience, but there's that G rating will always have a stigma attached to it. It will always have a stigma attached to it. And that's crazy. That's so crazy, because that swear word was a huge, that was a huge moment.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I remember my whole theater lighting up like, what, did he just say that? What, can we say that now?
Here's how big a moment that was. At least on the DVD version that I have, it's actually one of the menu cut scenes. where you can go right to that.
Awesome.
So, anyway, I think it's time to open up the theater and start the film, gentlemen.
Indeed.
Let's do it.
Do we want to do a countdown?
Yeah, let's do it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right.
And there's that classic Marvel Sunbow Productions.
Yeah.
As we get to humble
beginnings of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And as we get to, I remember seeing this. We're seeing Unicron for the first time, having no idea what the hell this is, but this panning shot of Unicron and just going, oh my God, this animation. This is normal Transformers movie.
It reminds me a little bit of Heavy Metal, that 70s.
Oh, good pull. Yeah, the Ralph Bakshi movie.
Yeah.
Good pull, yes.
Now, let me ask y'all, this part right here, do you think that there, because this is the prologue to the movie.
Yes.
Do you think that this is actually a gap between what we see and compared to what we, because we have, this is Kranix's home world, and I forget the name of it. I'll have to look it up, but how far along is it between
them? Well, the movie itself takes place 20 years after season 2.
Right.
As far as
that's right. Yeah, because I remember the announcement of the year in
2005.
Right.
Now
it was huge.
Now I'm looking at the scene now where Unicron starts eating the planet.
Yeah.
And how powerful this scene is. And you look at it and go, how much it's changed today, because there is no way at this time they would have allowed this to be a flesh planet that was getting devoured.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Not at all. Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting, too, because I love this moment here. You know, everything's opened up. He's eating the planet. And when the ship gets pulled back in.
And you see it go through the digestive system.
Yes. It's such a wonderful transition to, like, I mean... This is sort of the thing where it's amazing that this really is just a vehicle for, you know, promoting a toy line, but whoever created this movie, they obviously really cared that they were going to give you a worthwhile experience. Like that whole sequence blows your mind as a kid. Like, what did I just watch?
And here we absolutely come to the classic opening of Transformers, the movie, as White Lion rocks the Transformers theme.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely amazing. I love this soundtrack, let me tell you.
And the whole 2001-esque travel through that. Oh, just like, oh my gosh, it's so cool.
And Eric Idle getting top billing as the first voice actor. I mean, and at the time, this is a major voice cast for this time frame. You got Judd Nelson, who is at his peak, Leonard Nimoy, Robert Stack, Unsolved Mysteries.
Well, I mean, Leonard freaking Nimoy, you know, this is 4.
Yeah, I know.
Orson
Welles in his last performance. Transformers.
It's his very last screen appearance, Orson Welles. Ooh, from Citizen Kane to Transformers the movie. I mean, that is a hell of a career arc, you know, when you think about it. And you know, it's so, I mean, this movie really blew the doors open on the idea of that all-star cast, you know, like it changed everything in terms of, you know, who was going to, and I mean, Vince DiCola does the music for Rocky.
Yeah. Rocky IV.
You know, like, yeah. And that's amazing.
And I mean, look how sharp Laserbeak looks. Just how amazing this animation is.
Well, I mean, the animation is amazing, but at the same time, I think that it gets overlooked. The sound design on, you know, on this movie is so, like, this is a movie that essentially is just a kid's movie. This is just something they're just churning out, you know, with just a thought toward, you know, marketing. But this, for them to take so much time on the sound design to get that right is, like, sound, you know, to quote George Lucas, sound is half the experience. And that's what, that's one of the things that I think that really makes this movie work, is you have a great soundtrack and great sound design working together to make this cartoon feel real and come alive for the kids that are watching it.
Now, quick thing, we're looking at jazz on our screen. This movie was also Scatman Carruthers' last performance before he died.
Oh, was it the last? Yeah. It was the last one? Oh my gosh, I forgot that.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but how weird was it to see Spike as an adult?
Yeah. Oh yeah, thanks for calling that out. You're right. Yeah, that was, it was like, that's Spike.
So,
one would have to wonder.
I used to draw the ship that they traveled from the Cybertronian moons. I used to draw that ship design endlessly as a kid. Coming out of this movie, I was obsessed with that ship design. I thought it was the neatest thing I had seen since Star Wars. I was fascinated by it.
And you know, one of the cool things when Optimus just tells everyone, tells Cliffjumper, commence with a countdown, that was actually a nod to Casey Kasem, who was actually the voice of Cliffjumper.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe I've gone this long without catching that. Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at the playback now of, you know, what Laserbeak recorded. And I don't know about you guys, but what's about to come up at the time it happened was absolutely traumatizing.
Oh, are you kidding? Oh my gosh! And even the song that they
Instruments of Destruction.
Yes.
Now, I mean,
geez. This scene right here, blowing the hole in the ship, was like, oh no, now, what's going to happen? And this is the moment where things get real.
When you see Brawn get hit, now here's the thing. The first shot from Megatron in the entire cartoon series always missed in his gun mode. And then you see, is the one that threw me right here, Prowl. When you see his eyes go out and the smoke coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, saying that. Yeah, I'm thinking to myself for the first time, did I just see what I think I saw?
Yep. Yo, and even Ironhide getting shot, you're like, okay, that's a warrior's death. That's fitting for Ironhide. But for Ratchet to get hit, you're like, what? But no, he helps people. Like, you can't hurt him. That's not cool.
And then we're coming up to it, the scene where we all knew, okay, this is going to be different than anything we've ever seen. Right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you guys, but as a kid, I'm thinking the holy crap moment of the whole movie right there.
Oh yeah. Ironhide eating it like that is just, I don't know why anybody was surprised by anything that happened after that point, because they declare in the very, you know, it's within 8 minutes of the opening titles, even of the opening titles of the very first shot in the film. It's within 8 minutes that they throw cold water on the audience and let them know, like you said, like, this is not going to be anything that you've seen before. This is completely different.
Now, gentlemen, we must stop for a second because the greatness of Stan Bush is kicking in right about now.
Oh, on. I will let you know that to this day, on my running mixes, when I go out for a jog,
Dare and the Touch Dare
is indeed definitely on my running mixes.
Now, we all wanted jet skateboard, did we not?
I will point out, predates Back to the Future Part 2.
Oh, without a doubt.
And is a cooler hoverboard.
Oh, yes. Now, and here's the thing. With Dare, no matter what, I always said that's Hot Rod song.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Now, here's one of my favorite new characters, too, was Cup. I loved Cup.
I always thought Cup always was interesting to me because this was the first time I think that, Transformers really addresses the idea of some Transformers are old and some Transformers are young, which when you think about it, along with all of the other things, is sort of a mind-blowing concept because it's like they were ageless in the cartoon.
Yeah.
There was one no of concept of like a robot being older or younger.
And we just hit one of my favorite shots where Hot Rod drops down that zoom and you see him looking through that. I thought that was a great shot.
And how much do you love that Starscream is the first one to get hit?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I know. Is it bad that when I first watched this movie, I really wanted Starscream just to bite it?
Oh, and
Starscream was such an ass.
Now, and here we go right off the bat, and I know this is going to be heartbreaking because the Insecticons take a pounding in this.
Yeah, no, they're yes, they are treated very poorly throughout the duration of this film. Yeah, no doubt. Oh my gosh, and but what a great way to introduce the new characters is to have them be heroic, like right off the bat.
Yeah.
There's no sort of like tentative thing. They're immediately taking control. They've already declared, that these characters are important. Like, without stopping and having Optimus Prime say, Cup, you are my trusted lieutenant. Like they've actually, and this is one of the things that I harp on about this movie. What makes it so special and makes it work is they don't do the pandering moment of character introduction where the first time you meet a character is an old character you're familiar with, slapping him on the shoulder and telling you why you should care about them.
And here we
you
go.
Find out why you should care.
You're jumping into four brand new characters right here. And I don't know about you guys, but I was blown away to see a female Autobot after it had been so long.
Oh, yeah. And how much do you love that she has the Princess Leia buns on the side of her head?
Well, if you remember, there was an episode, I think, in the second season where they go back to Cybertron and the female Autobots are there.
Yeah, Alita 1.
Firestar.
Yeah, and there was one other.
And a couple other ones.
Now,
yeah,
I have to admit, Blur was always one of my favorites because he was one of the first toys I got from the new line.
I always regretted never being able to find. I don't recall if I ever made one, but an RC toy.
The first RC toy came out last year. Was the first time they ever made it.
You are kidding me. You are kidding.
Well,
I would, as a young boy, I would have bought that in a heartbeat.
Yes. And technically,
great shot of Starscream right here, by the way.
Oh,
sorry
to
interrupt.
But yeah.
Now, let me ask you guys this, as we're watching this scene, aren't we all thinking, oh my God, we're going to see Metroplex? Because there's the tank right there that was part of Metroplex.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, though, there's so much about this because we talked about Robotech earlier. There's so much about that transformation scene that speaks of Robotech, that idea. Yeah. Like there's a very SDF-1 feel to the way things transform
Wait a minute. Gentlemen, we're about to have more Insecticon abuse here in just a minute. Because Kickback gets screwed. There's no other way to put it.
It's a little heavy on the electrons. They were a little slow. They were a little intoxicated by electrons.
Oh, that had to hurt.
Oh, this one's going to hurt more.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, we're coming up to one of my favorite scenes in this movie, this scene with Blaster. Because for the first time ever, we see Autobot cassettes.
Absolutely. That was the coolest thing to be able to see when he said, two can play this game, and all of a sudden, every single tape ejects.
Yeah.
And I think we were all just in shock, because I don't think anybody was expecting that.
No, because remember, when he was first released, he did not have any cassettes with him, which I thought was very strange.
And he was impossible to open up his cassette holder.
Okay, so
was.
So in terms of preference, back then, I'm guessing Soundwave definitely wanted out for you.
Oh yeah, so, I mean, come
but
on, Sound
as an adult, Soundwave or Blaster?
Still Soundwave. I mean,
Soundwave. Okay,
yeah, but I will say this: I did love Blaster's cassettes because I thought you had a Rhinoceros and you had Steeljaw.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I love all of Soundwave's cassettes when they swarm over Perceptor.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's just such a fun scene. You know, the idea that they're just swarming over him. But yeah, you're right. Like when Blaster responds with his own guys.
Well, and yeah, and I love this line coming up. You think you got through to Prime? I don't know, but if I didn't, we're all gonna look like burned out toaster ovens.
Yeah. But again, how great is this transition? This idea, because this is even different, because this is really taking advantage of the format, because everything on the show is resolved within 30 minutes. Whereas this has the, you know, they're very much focused on the idea of an assault that lasts a really long time.
Okay. And another heartbreaking scene coming up too.
Oh yeah. But at the same time, you know, mixed in with one of my favorite movie lines of all time. Yeah. One of my absolute favorite movie lines of all time. I've got better things to do today than die.
But
come on.
I cried when I saw Wheeljack.
Oh, I know.
Oh, sure.
That was a tough... Wheeljack was always one of my favorites, and that was a tough one. And come on, I love the banter between Hot Rod and RC.
Oh, it's classic.
Classic. And what's great is they kind of set up this little Transformers love triangle.
Yeah.
Between Hot Rod, Springer, and RC.
I love this. Here it comes. Here he comes. Here comes your toy.
Yep. Devastator. And he just goes to town.
You know, it's funny. In the IDW comic book adaption, there's a couple of
line.
Deleted scenes.
Oh, there are?
Well, according to God, I saw some of the artwork, and it was where Omega Supreme and the Aerial Bots were fighting the Combaticons and Stunticons.
Yeah, there's a note about that in the film. That was supposed to be in the film, and they took it out. Another thing was they were supposed to introduce a new set of Dragon Autobots that were a combiner, that they were the ones that were going to take out Devastator.
Did you guys ever did you buy the trading cards that were based on shots from this movie?
I had the sticker book. The sticker book.
Okay, the sticker book. Because there were trading cards. I remember trading cards that came out. My cousin and I, the cousin that had the collection that I coveted. Oh, and this shot. Yeah. I remember the card with Devastator tearing that door. And this moment, the Autobots coming in. Oh,
the Grimlock love challenge. Now, how much did it bother you guys that we only got four of the five Dinobots in this film?
Yeah, that was kind of a strange decision.
Because you see Snarl once, a little bit late, briefly, but yeah, you only got the four. Slag, which was the first Dinobot I owned, so he has a soft spot, and Swoop, who throughout the series always got abused. And here we go. Megatron must be stopped, no matter the cost.
Oh, I mean, come on. Name to me another movie, even present day, that has a better music cue than this.
Oh, without a doubt.
Come on.
There's none.
Now, I'll even go one further on this. Name me another movie except outside of it, maybe Aliens, where more things are quoted from it.
Star Trek 4.
I will say this, that one of the single greatest nods / moments of my adult film going life, adult being a relative term, was when I saw Boogie Nights in the movie theater and they had Mark Wahlberg singing The Touch in the movie studio. I was that guy.
Yeah.
Who was laughing and clapping and standing up and saying, yes, this song. Thank you for including it.
And how about this?
So happy.
This when we just have this classic exchange between Optimus Prime and Megatron.
Yeah, no, I'll do it. Yeah. But even that classic trope of the villain who says, no, I won't use my natural advantage. I'm going to beat you with my bare hands. I will beat you in a fair fight. You know, like the whole idea that the villain has this code of honor where it's just not worth it if he can't try to take out the hero on his own terms. And then a lightsaber, a Transformers lightsaber. Come on.
And the greatest uppercut of all time.
Oh, yeah. But look at that shot.
Yeah.
I mean, what an incredible shot to have him silhouetted by the sun and the fist coming up. Like, there's a real the direction of this does not treat its source material like it's just a cartoon. This is predating Pixar in terms of treating it as if, you know, this is real action, real characters, and real impact. This isn't treating it the way that, and this is the reason I think that this movie still stands out with so many fans and with so many people who weren't even like huge Transformers people, is this fight alone is so cinematically composed and so compelling. Like, you can just show this scene, and even if the person's not a Transformers fan, you get everything you need from this moment. And Optimus getting shot, come on.
Oh, and
you know,
then,
like, there's a shot that he's down.
And then you look, you see Megatron right there looking completely battle damaged. And then this shot right here, where Optimus with the axe handle punch.
Yep. Just completely wrecks him. I don't know, man. I'm not lying to myself, you know, am I? Like, this whole idea of just how beautifully composed all of this is.
Oh, there are movies that could take, there are directors who need to look at this to do, and it's fight choreography 101 for them, because there are directors today that really could stand to learn something from this scene.
But again, to speak to the idea that this is simply for the sake of franchise advancement.
Yeah. Now,
for the sake of introducing new characters.
Look inside Junk, right? Seeing Rumble running along carrying Megatron's blaster.
Oh, yeah. but how many movies? And you know what? I will even throw my beloved Stark on this burning pile, right? How many Stark movies exist where, yeah, as a fan, you love them, but at the same time, it's just there to keep the brand alive. And the whole stated purpose of this movie is to keep the brand alive, but you have that fight scene that is so carefully and beautifully put together. And then, I mean, the scene that defined childhood for so many people right now.
I held back tears. It was hard not to cry with the scene. I mean,
did you cry when you saw it?
I was in disbelief. I mean, I was at the point, because even when you hear this music,
yeah,
you're just going, he's about to die. What's happening? And I think this is the first time we hear the Matrix leadership, isn't it?
Yes.
Correct.
Now, it's the first time that I recall. Yeah.
Yeah. Now here's what I find interesting when they bring this up. And it's something I've always just felt with this mystery. When how much the Matrix looks like Unicron.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I never even thought about that, but you're right. It does. Wow. Do we have any, did anybody say that was on purpose, or is that just a sort of like
it's just something I've always just kind of saw there. I mean,
my gosh, they should totally, because it's the one thing that can destroy Unicron. They should totally.
Look at it. You've got the globe in the center with the open mouth, and you've got the ring around it that you used to hold it.
They should totally have at least a comic book series that monopolizes on that. Were born from the same place.
Foreshadowing.
Oh, sure.
Now, funny you should mention about the comic books, but currently with IDW, I don't think Unicron or the Quintessons are anywhere in that universe.
No, not that I'm aware of. And then we hit this scene right here, Flatline. And I think for me, what made this even more hit home is you see Optimus, and I think this is a brilliant move. Not only do you see the eyes glow dim, but he goes completely gray.
Yeah, which is such an interesting concept. Once the spark of life is gone from them, that everything that gives them color. Now, people could talk forever about how this scene affected them or affects them. And like the one thing is that, you know, we have everything from disbelief to fighting back tears to crying in the theater. Like, there was no question about this at the time. Was there for you that he was going to come back? That there was no idea of this being anything but the final act for Optimus Prime, right?
Yeah. Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the same. Now we get to this interesting, wonderful Decepticon. And you know this is just how it would roll with the Decepticons.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. No, but, I love the idea that they're so cutthroat that they would cast aside their own dead weight.
Yeah. Now, but there's a scene. I mean, we're talking about classic characters here. We're talking about Skywarp, Thundercracker, and the Insecticons, and then obviously Megatron.
But, yeah, I.
And this is great. Starscream's
farewell to Megatron is wonderful.
Yeah. Now, here's what I love, and guys, correct me if I'm wrong. Here they are all riding an Astro Train, who can't be that big, but yet somehow the Constructicons are able to form Devastator inside of Astro Train.
I have an explanation for this. I actually have. I was thinking about this in preparation for this, because this is something that even as a young boy, I was like, "How the hell is he that large inside?" And it's the idea of volume and rearrangement. That when Astro Train is a robot, he's very compact. He's very dense, right? He's sort of like a dense ball of mercury. But you can spread it out and create, you know, something like a Dyson sphere out of it if it's spread thinner. So my theory is that all of the parts that make him when he's robot size rearrange in such a way that basically it's all of this empty space inside of him is prearranged for the sake of bringing him back down to normal robot size. So like he's a bunch of different plates that slide together in a different way that probably somebody who actually has a degree in physics could explain in some way. That
where's Neil deGrasse Tyson when we need him?
Yeah. Okay. Come on, man.
Well, one thing that's explained in the IDW comics is called mass shifting.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's mass shifting. Yeah. Where that's how Megatron can become a gun. And, you know, and I think Broadside, which we hardly ever see on the show, who was the triple changer for the Autobots, they said he could become this massive aircraft carrier, but if he spreads himself out so much, he's more vulnerable.
Yeah. Quick side note. We're getting to
I love this part.
This part is amazing. Orson Welles was so sick at the time that they cut his dialogue by 3/4. Because they
really?
Couldn't under,
I
they
didn't
could,
know that.
They cut. They could not understand him by the end of this movie. There were rumors for the longest time that Leonard Nimoy actually voiced Unicron for parts of this film.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. That's actually really heartbreaking.
And I believe he died like 5 days after he filmed, or he did the voiceover for it.
Yeah. Now, to me, this scene was one of the coolest scenes in the film.
Oh yeah, no.
Oh,
where Megatron gets remade.
Yes.
That I thought that was amazing, just because the way that they did it, the way that they do it, of like the whole mapping of him and the way that he gets reformed is so incredibly cool looking. But I think the nicest touch about it is the fact that it's painful.
Yeah.
The fact that you hear Megatron screaming.
Yeah. I accept
while it's
your
happening.
Terms.
It's not this
I
idea
accept.
Of, right. Yeah.
One other thing I will say about this scene, it has probably caused the biggest debate in the history of Transformers. Not so much with Megatron.
Who is Cyclonus?
But who is Cyclonus? Who are the sweeps? And what happened to the second Cyclonus? Because if you watch...
Yes.
Behold, Galvatron. But now watch.
I loved Galvatron's head design, too.
I used
to draw that all the time.
Everybody figures that was Skywarp who was traded into Scourge. But we have two Cycloneses, Bombshell and Thundercracker. What happened to the second Cyclonus? And where did the extra sweep come from? Because it shows 4 sweeps.
Well, it's all of the leftover parts.
Yeah.
From when he remade them. He had to cast aside certain parts, and he had an extra one left.
Don't you remember there was one of the Insecticons could actually replicate himself?
Yes, but still, I mean, so and then all of a sudden now we have 4 sweeps and only 1 Cyclonus.
I just say that's due to animation error.
Yeah.
That's sort of like the in the original version of The Empire Strikes Back. The Star Destroyer engines that are there that suddenly disappear like half a second after it cuts to the executor master shot when you first see the ship.
This scene is hilarious, but quick final note with Galvatron. Obviously, we go to Leonard Nimoy voicing Galvatron. However, when they go back to season 3, Frank Welker is voicing Galvatron.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was all sorts of wrong.
Yeah.
This stuff like that actually bothered me.
Now, I will say this. You know, greatest Transformer death ever about to happen.
Oh,
absolutely. And I don't know if anyone else saw that with Beast Wars. You ever watch Beast Wars?
Yes, I remember.
No.
They actually had a continuity with this one because Starscream's ghost appears in the Beast Wars cartoon.
Nice. That's awesome. But I love this shot of Galvatron transforming and stepping on the crown. Is in a lot of ways, I don't know, I have any idea whether they did it on purpose or not, but in a lot of ways sort of calls to mind Napoleon when, you know, the Pope is going to go crown him and he takes the crown from the Pope and he's like, I don't need you. You know, like stepping on the crown. In that sense, it's sort of like Galvatron just saying, I'm the leader. I don't care. You know, in a sense, it highlights right away the major difference between, the being of Galvatron and the being of Megatron. Is Megatron was very much into the shows of leadership and force, and Galvatron is much more, I'm the leader, and that's just the way that it is. I'm not going to stand on ceremony here.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of love that moment.
So we returned back to the Autobots at Metroplex, and they're doing damage control.
And we're
we only see a few of them.
Yeah, while we're Unicron is getting his first snack of the day.
Yeah, and the thing is, as we're watching this, I'm having so many flashbacks to those cards I made reference to.
Oh yeah,
because they had those just frozen shots. And one of my favorite frozen shots was anytime I got a card where Unicron was eating something.
Yeah.
I just thought that was the coolest thing.
And what's funny is Jazz obviously is one of the few original Autobots to survive. And he's actually in the first episode of season 3, but they don't even call him Jazz. He's got some funky name.
Oh, yeah.
Some other planet, because he wins that race that Blur was complaining about that he couldn't compete in because he was on guard duty or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Oh. Now, maybe he took a shot out to the head during the attack, and he just forgot who he was. Who knows?
Post-traumatic stress from
Unicron. He went to the witness protection.
Yeah. Oh, you know, and even this is done so great with the countdown.
And then we're about to have a great moment in history.
Yeah, it is a complete epochal shift in terms of the way I approach language.
Yes.
So don't say that movies don't have an effect.
I love this because it establishes Unicron still has control of Galvatron.
Oh, well, yeah, no, but how cool is that, too? Like, the idea that he controls him from a distance with, like, that mind control thing. It's such a neat idea of, you know, being able to torment that Megatron, this he trades death for life. But in exchange, you know, Megatron, you know, so much as, you know, we were talking in the previous scene about him being like Napoleon with regards to the other Decepticons. He's more powerful than any of the other Decepticons. But Megatron's not used to being second fiddle to anybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what a major shift that is, that there's anybody that's willing to just basically treat him the way that he treated Starscream.
Yeah. Now, quick question for you guys.
Oh, he basically sold his soul.
Yeah. We just saw Daniel. By the time the movie was over, we're all wondering, okay, it's very obvious who Daniel's mom has to be, right?
Right.
Now, see, there's RC? Your only snarl appearance in the film.
Yeah, it's right here.
Now, how cool is this? I was just going to say, how cool is it that we see Galvatron actually riding in Cyclonus?
Oh,
but
yeah,
at the same time,
coolest things.
But at the same time, how kind of weird is that? Like, does that feel strange for a Transformer to have somebody riding inside them? Like, is there some sort of like intimacy level that I'm unfamiliar with?
I don't think so, because if you look at the old the ones before this one, Cosmos, he would actually carry some to and from. So,
or Omega Supreme.
I don't think it was. Yeah.
But it's just one of those things where it's like, I don't know. I mean, even Astro Train, right? You know, like, does it feel weird? Like, you've got people inside you. Like, that's just, I don't know. That's just sort of strange to me.
Now,
and Galvatron being inside, like, is Galvatron actually piloting? Or is he just along for the ride?
Yeah. Now, let me ask you guys something, because a lot of these figures came out before the movie came out. And when the Scourge figure first came out, please tell me you weren't all thinking, why did they make a Transformer that's a boat?
Yeah, it was sort of an interesting design. It was sort of an interesting choice.
And yet, I love this.
Say in my headcanon.
I love this. They're trying to escape, and here's Grimlock begging for Cup's war stories right in the middle of a battle.
Oh,
yeah.
But even this, the comic relief, we're talking about the way the movie's constructed. How brilliantly is the comic relief constructed in this movie?
Which you can tell at this time, they already have that friendship because he loves, I love hearing Cup's war stories. So, you know, Cup's been saying that to him for what, 20 years now or whatnot. So that's what I always thought was just so cool about it because, you know, even though it's our first time meeting all these new Autobots, they've known each other for a while.
Yeah. And I got to, again, we've got another classic Vince DiCola score going on right now too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I even, oh gosh, I even remember, the technology has changed so much, but having the original soundtrack on cassette tape, and this track in specific, when I finally got the soundtrack on cassette tape, I had this rinky-dink little cassette player. It was, take a boombox and shrink it down to about the size of two palms put together, right, width-wise. And I would walk in, there's no headphones, and I would walk in playing this track from the soundtrack. I would walk to school listening to it. And it's one of those things where you look back on it now, and if you were to look back on it, you say to yourself, what a giant signal I was sending to the world of what a nerd I was. That, you know, all of my other friends have like legit boom boxes and radios and stuff like that. And they're playing like Van Halen and they're playing all of the, you know, Def Leppard and all of this popular music. And I'm walking along playing a Vince DiCola track from the Escape from Earth in Transformers, the movie, on a tiny little radio player. That's, you know, so small, like what a marked difference between myself and my peers at that time in my life. And so every time I hear the music, like, and watch that scene, that's like what I think of. It's like, man, I was really showing myself to the world at that point.
Yeah. Now, I love this scene here where you had Cup kind of started telling this story to the Dinobots, and Hot Rod interrupts saying, shouldn't we be more worried about other things? So, and then we go right into this chase scene with the Decepticons. And I'll tell you what, this is one of the things I wish they would have made as a toy, because I love this Decepticon Galvatron warship design.
Oh yeah.
I thought it was so cool. It's just the fact that both the Autobot shuttles, they're different. I mean, one's blue, one's red, but there's just subtle differences to them that makes them both unique.
Yeah. And I love the Cyclonus design as well.
Oh yeah, he's an amazing looking vessel.
But you know what? He calls to mind that the G.I. Joe was the X-38,
the Conquest X-30.
Yeah,
X-30. Okay, yeah. But that's what he looked like to me. He looked like a very futuristic version of that.
And this crashing,
and you have to add, yes,
that's just right out. That felt like something right out of Heavy Metal too. Just the way the ship collapses on them like that so fast.
Well, even the planet design, like, is so neat, of what turns out to be the Quintessons planet. And this is the specific moment coming up where that made me obsess over this ship design is
right. The separation.
The separation again. Hey, predating something that we knew and love. I think Star Trek: The Next Generation took a little tip from this right here.
Prepare for saucer separation.
Yeah. But even the way the missiles move is very reminiscent of the anime / Robotech type of style.
Yes.
You know, and the explosion right there is very reminiscent of Robotech.
Yep. And I love Scourge, the Transformer with the pirate beard and mustache.
Decepticon Buccaneer Scourge.
Who was Harry Mudd?
Wait, the guy who Carmel. Really? He did the voice for him?
Yeah.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Isn't that cool?
I had no idea. That's what I get for not paying close enough attention to the credits all these years. Oh, that's awesome.
Now,
all right,
what I laughed about here was hitting the comic relief using Perceptor with Ultra Magnus just being completely bored.
Yeah.
And talk about your worst case scenarios after a crash.
But even think about this. Okay, this is one of the things that I think that we've lost over time. And I think that this scene here showing all of the fish, the robot fish going around eating other robot fish while robots are trapped in robot seaweed and robot seagrass and all of that stuff under water. How amazingly absurd is all of this stuff of this sort of like robot ecosystem? But we were willing to just say whatever and just roll with it and just be cool with it. Whereas nowadays, if they were to release something like this, even kids, we've even trained the youngest child to look at it and say, well, how does the physics of that work? And you know, robot squid. Why would a robot squid exist? Who cares? It looks
cool. Who built it?
You know? Right. What does it matter?
Now,
and just have fun and let your imagination go.
Now, we're watching the scene with Hot Rod where his hand changes out and he's got the blade coming out. Wasn't that something we wanted from all of our Transformers from the show that they never really did, except later on in some of the remakes with Optimus? They had all these hand things that they could change, and you're like, why can't they make an accessory pack where we can do this with our Transformers?
Would have been nice. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you are right, John. I mean, when I watched this the other day to get ready for this podcast, I was thinking in my mind going, this is a pretty traumatic experience as a 11, 12-year-old watching this movie. I'm going, wow. But, I mean, because everything that just went wrong has gone wrong right now.
Yeah. Now, here's something I'm looking at, too. It's like, okay, wait a minute. We had Transformers die earlier in this. Cup gets basically ripped apart, but Hot Rod can put him back together.
Right. Cup has the advantage of being a new character. So yeah. He was not under the mandate to die.
And we're,
but look at the Junkticons planet too. Like even now we build where's the sun? How can it stay together like that? And all of that stuff. Who cares? It's a great concept and just have fun with it.
Oh, without a doubt. And I mean, I'm looking at these animation sequences and just how sharp the animation is.
Yeah, although I will, you have to acknowledge that there is an inconsistency where sometimes you can tell they were maybe getting the A team and sometimes they were maybe getting the B team
in terms of
putting things together. Because there are definitely moments where, like, you know, you look at that crash scene and you look at, you know, the way that this planet is constructed, you're like, wow, look at that. Look at all the shading. Look at all of that stuff. And then they have other transition scenes where, like, somebody kind of phoned that in, or that was the intern.
Now, what I want to know is when are Child and Family Services going to come in on the Autobots about their putting such young children into incredibly dangerous situations?
Parenting was at different standards back then.
Now, here's a question. I really wasn't big on the exosuit until about 10 minutes later in this film, when we saw what the exosuit could really do.
I was always trying to figure out how his body fit into it and how it worked because you know, like the arms were too big. So like, obviously he's like scrunched in, but the chest is too small for the way it would have to work, which I guess speaks directly against my idea of just rolling with it. I guess as a kid, I just thought it was neat, you know, that he was in his own exosuit. And as an adult, I'm laying on that sort of like Star Trek fan layer to it of like, how does it work? What's the technology behind it? And it's like, I mean, have they ever gone into a history of how the Junkticons came to be?
Not that because I'm aware
of. Because we meet all of these different robot planets.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? I always loved the look of the Junkions. I just thought it was a very intriguing look. and how they fight, as we'll see in a little bit, I also thought was very original thinking, kind of a Transformer Mad Max in their fight style.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, if you notice, the Junkions, so they weren't Decepticons or Autobots, and you had to wonder, like, which faction did they belong to?
Yeah, and I know that I've been botching it saying Junkticon. I've been doing that since I was a wee lad. Like, I always trip over that I want to immediately say Autobot or Decepticon. Like, it's just automatically ingrained in my brain.
And here we go. The greatest introduction line of all time.
And my cousin, you know, speaking of toys that didn't quite match what you experienced in the movie, the Sharkticons were definitely in that category.
Yeah. Now, come on. We've all used Ba Weep, Guana Weep, Ninny Bong in bars to pick up girls, right?
I've used it as both the entrance and outro to presentations that I've given.
Now, and this has always been a bummer to me. They actually never made a toy of this particular Sharkticon design.
Right.
The actual Sharkticons, or were they the Gator Cons, or whatever you want to call them?
Do you get those in Florida? If they had come to Earth, would they naturally migrate to Florida? The Alligatoricons?
I'm thinking so. Now, we just saw the introduction of, to me, is always one of the more bizarre Transformers, and that was Wheelie. Because I think we all agree the Wheelie toy was horrid.
Yeah.
I can agree with that, but I will tell you what, the bio on him was pretty ingenious right there.
Yeah.
To be the lone survivor, crashed. I mean, all right, he went crazy by doing rhymes.
Yeah. Now, we're seeing the Quintessons for the first time, none of us having any idea just how important they are to Transformers lore at this point.
Which wound up being so weird, because what I always associate with them is, as a kid, seeing them, like, I mean, the first time I saw this movie, and even today, like, I look at them, and they weird me out, man.
Oh,
the fact that, like, it goes through all five heads laughing, and so is that five consciousnesses? Is that one brain expressing itself five different ways? What's happening right here? Like,
I'll tell you, even when they're
really creepy. Yeah,
well, and here's the thing: even when they switched faces, it felt like each face had its own personality.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was really interesting is Kranix himself. He's the one that actually said in the very first part of the movie, "It's Unicron," and it makes me wonder, because Cup says later, "What's Unicron?" Yeah. And you have to wonder what the lore behind it throughout all the galaxies, everything. And they do explain it a little bit in the Deviations comic book. Just a tiny bit.
Yeah. There was definitely some things like that. But what an incredibly dark scene.
Oh, sure.
Oh, absolutely.
And here we go. We have our classic Dinobot moment.
No, but see, now I'm fixated on the fact that there are only four of them, because that's sort of like something that mentally I've let slide over time, and now that we're watching it, I'm like, yeah, where the hell, what is happening?
I'm gonna say in my headcanon that Snarl was injured; he had to stay behind.
He didn't make it onto the ship. RC made it. Oh, off screen moment.
Yeah.
He can't make it, and he says, "You go on," and RC keeps running.
Yep.
I'm down with that.
And here we go. The mighty Grimlock taken down by a slingshot.
Now, here's a question. Oh no, go on.
So what's the question?
Please. Oh, no, please go on.
To say that the new Hasbro Wheelie that's coming out this year looks almost like the movie version.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, they've gotten so good with the toys and what they're able to do now. They look so great.
Oh, they look amazing.
So is Wheelie the Jar Jar Binks of the Transformers universe?
No, because I think there are people who have a genuine love for Wheelie.
Hey, you're talking to a guy who has a genuine, I wouldn't say love, but like for Jar Jar. I actually like the character. But I'm always curious with Wheelie because he's sort of he's like the one character. Like if you talk to somebody about seeing Transformers the movie, nobody gets to Wheelie. You know, they talk about everything else. And then you're like, oh, and Wheelie. And they're like, oh, yeah, right, Wheelie. So he seems eminently forgettable, which is so weird.
Well, because I think it's partly because he has such a key part in this one area, and then he's just basically forgot about the rest of the way.
No, that's a good point. If they can't worry about him, why should I?
Yeah. But think about it. We introduced the Junkions, and because Wreck-Gar is voiced by Eric Idle, and two, their ship crashing through the eye of their ship getting crushed by Unicron later in this always is brought up. How did everybody on that ship survive?
Right.
Escape pod.
Yeah. Now, again, I love the fact that we have Transformers that are still in their. And wait, it's an Insecticon. Wait a minute. Wasn't he just changed? An animation editor wasn't paying attention right there.
That's the good. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Actually, that's supposed to be Chop Shop.
Now, they called in reinforcements from Cybertron.
Yeah. Interesting thing coming up as we kind of deal with the quote unquote death of Ultra Magnus. The original script had the sweeps taking Ultra Magnus and pulling him apart.
Grim.
And it was actually portrayed that way in the Marvel comic movie adaptation. But when they brought the shot preparation for this movie, they felt it was too violent. So they went.
Agree with them. I would definitely agree with them. I think the audience, especially the kids, have been through enough that like seeing somebody get yanked apart like that, you know, like basically drawn and quartered.
Yeah.
That would have been a little too far.
And here we go again. Here's another Autobot surviving because he's part of the new toy line.
Yeah, right? Yeah, now, I mean, he gets beaten up worse than Prime.
Yeah, and here's the thing. And this is something that's always kind of bothered me because here they set up Ultra Magnus, who's supposed to be one of the best warriors in the Autobot army. And because of how he's portrayed in this film, he's portrayed as weak through the entire rest of the series. Nobody can take him seriously.
Yeah. I have another Quintesson question for you since we're back there and they just passed judgment. The guy who has the floating tentacle arms, do you think that he counts as a cyborg? Do you think that there's enough organic matter to him to justify calling him a cyborg type?
I don't know, because you don't necessarily know that's organic matter. Those could be mechanical arms with just kind of a flesh look. Because, I mean, think about it. Later on, and we never really see him in the American episodes of Transformers, but we do get the Pretenders.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right. No, and actually also the Sharkticon's tails are... It's just, it seems... it seems to speak of organic material because you don't see like those sort of like rivet lines that the Sharktacons have on their tails and stuff like that.
And here we go with another great song from the soundtrack, the song Hungry.
Hunger, yes. Huh. I just love the fact that it rips off the tail of one of them and beats the others with it.
Oh, I know. It's great.
Like, how hardcore old warrior is that?
And then just, Hot Rod throwing the punch and knocking out all the teeth.
Yeah, that got a big laugh. I remember in the movie theater when I saw it.
And classic Dinobots. And one of the things that makes me sad is Slag doesn't even go by Slag in the Transformers universe anymore. He's called Slug now.
Really?
Yeah, there's some kind of copyright issue. But, you know, classic Dinobots here with Grimlock. They basically all fall in line to Grimlock, and he just assumes, okay, I'm the king of the planet now.
I think weren't you saying that Slag is now Slug because I think it was some type of a British derogatory word or slang.
Yeah. And that could have been
Slag does. Yes, it carries a very negative. It's a very negative word in British slang. You're absolutely right. I won't describe what it means, but Urban Dictionary is out there in case anybody wants to. And look at this. They've instigated a complete revolution right on the Quintessons planet. So I have to ask, how well run do you think that planet is once the Quintessons are deposed? The Sharktacons being in control doesn't seem to be the best form of government as an alternative.
Yeah. Now, here we go again. You know, we see we're back on the planet of junk. Have you guys ever in your life seen the original Springer figure?
Yes.
No, I haven't.
And here we go. We've got Mad Max Junkions. I mean, you just look at the design of these characters. I mean, it feels like, okay, yep, these are Road Warrior Transformers.
Yeah, but I think it also speaks again to that whole idea of, and I think you called this out earlier, of whimsy, where this crash right here, you know, where they then, you know, switch positions. That's really kind of neat. Like, you know, we had never seen that before.
And of course, we're watching this and we got Weird Al playing in the background. As we've got a little Dare to be Stupid playing during this scene.
But you know, that song actually fits.
Oh, without a doubt. It's great placement of a song. And really, that's, again, what we've talked about this before. That's what makes one of the things of this movie is the sound placement. And yet another Transformer with a sword. Who knew sword play would become so big in Transformers lore?
Yeah, fair point.
Well, remember, Redcar's got an axe.
Yeah. Well, and what I remember, too, is the scene. We see Springer, and for the first time, we find out he actually is a triple changer. And that's the first ever Autobot triple changer we've ever seen. And do we really do we really need to go into the physics of how this ship flies?
No. How awesome was that? I was saying, how awesome is that ship design? It's amazing. I think it's so cool. I suppose the nipples on Rekkar are a little unsettling. Sort of a Joel Schumachery.
And I do love the fact Hot Rod is actually learning from Cup.
Yes. Well, and
oh,
you
this
know,
is a great moment.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, let me ask you two. Have y'all thought that Cup has always been Hot Rod or Rodimus's mentor the entire, like, ever? I mean, since they've been together?
Oh, without a doubt.
I actually think, see, I always took it as he wanted to be his mentor, but, like, it was never, the Hot Rod would never let him. I always took the relationship as Cup wanted to be like an older brother, but he was too old for it. So Cup treated him like a grandfather. I'm sorry. Hot Rod treated him like a grandfather, even though he wanted to be an older brother. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, it was something in the third season of the show that I felt disappointed that they kind of got away from, of Cup being that mentor to Rodimus. It was early on, they kind of focused on it, and then they kind of just forgot about it, put to the wayside. And here we go, you know. Ultra Magnus, blown into a million little pieces. Little wax, little spit shine, little chunky on action. It's all good. He's alive. But we can't say Prime.
That's Junkion Elixir.
If only Prime had been shot by Megatron near the Junkions, all of this could have been solved. Now, we've talked about the relationship between Hot Rod and Cup. In those terms, how, like, did you guys like Cup as a character?
I did.
Both during and after the movie?
I did, because I think we've talked about it even a little bit, is the aspect of, hey, we have older Autobots that have been around for a long time. I mean, the only other time we've really seen that in the show is when we had Alpha Trion around.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, because I had when I was a kid, I had a hard time plugging into Cup. I won't lie. Like, it was, I came to like him a lot, but it was really, like, first viewing, I was kind of like, I was very lukewarm on him.
Well, I think part of that is he kind of had a very plain vehicle mode. He was like, what? He's a space truck. He's a space Ford Ranger.
He's a space Camino, actually.
Futuristic El Camino.
Yeah.
Now, we've made a couple references to heavy metal in this commentary. How heavy metal does it feel at this scene right here, where you've got Galvatron wearing the Matrix with a chain?
Yeah, right.
Oh, absolutely.
Look at my bling, he's saying.
But here's a question for you. Wouldn't you test the Matrix to see if you could open it before you got to Galvatron, or before you got to Unicron?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you, like, test things out first and be like, let me make sure this plane of mine works?
Yeah. Now, how mind-blowing was this to see Unicron transform for the first time?
Oh, it was so gorgeous. This, when the hand popped out, I remember just saying, oh my, are you kidding me? It was such a fantastic transformation. Unicron as a design concept was just always fascinating to me. And I know I keep going back to the design concept stuff, but like Galvatron and the Junkions and the Junkion planet and the Quintessons, and then Unicron was just, what an amazing dream come true for a Transformers fan. It's a planet that transforms.
Now, for a long time, and there was actually a script that had this in it, they had Cybertron transforming to fight Unicron.
Really?
Oh yeah. Actually,
really?
I
don't know.
It did continue in the Armada. Was it Transformers Armada? It was Unicron trilogy. Yeah.
And just how great is this shot right here, where he's just like, it's an hors d'oeuvre, Galvatron.
Yeah, well, he does the worst possible thing he can do when you think about it, because yeah, I mean, it's the it's that sort of like the movie villain mistake where it's like, why don't you just kill him? You've shown you can just kill him. Just kill him. Why are you doing this? Like, you just put him inside you where he can do worse things to you. And he's holding the one thing that can destroy you.
Yeah. And here we go. We have another Standbush moment as Dare starts playing again.
I really loved it during this time when Rod, I think it was Hot Rod that turns the cup, says, have you ever seen anything like this? The whole time he says, this reminds me of X. This reminds me of Y. He goes, nope.
I've never seen anything like this before. And that's just that. So that's such a great reinforcement of how dangerous the situation is.
Oh, the shot of them going through Unicron's eyes too.
Yeah.
This is just so much next level stuff, you know, for a kid who's a Transformers fan watching this movie, or the fact that Unicron has like an immune system.
Yeah. And then I love this shot coming up here where Galvatron is somewhat illuminated by the Matrix.
Well, also, I mean, you know, and I, again, talking about the composition, yes, the scene of him being illuminated, this is a very, it looks almost like Tron right there, right? But just the shot of, you know, Hot Rod is the one glimpse of real color. Hot Rod and the Matrix of Leadership are the only glimpses of real color. Everything else, including Galvatron, is gray and purple. Very bland, very blended in. And meanwhile, like, just the visual palette tells you who the hero is, who has the real power in this scenario. It, you know, like, this is, you know, art direction and cinematography worthy of any other film you're going to see.
Oh, I completely agree. I completely agree. And then to see Unicron shooting this one laser beam.
Yeah. but just, I mean, him standing on Cybertron, just standing on it, wrecking it. He's not bothering to eat it. He's actually wrecking something that could give him sustenance just to be spiteful.
And I just kind of love the scene where you have the Dinobots, which have always been considered these powerful Transformers, doing absolutely nothing, just to hammer home a point.
Here's a question for you, though. As he's on Cybertron and he's wrecking things, and he normally eats planets and all of that sort of stuff, could Unicron get sustenance like Galactus from a biological world like Earth? If Unicron had come to Earth, would he have been able to eat it and process it the way he does these robot planets?
Well, and I think that's a question, and this goes back to what we talked about even at the beginning of the film. There's no way we would ever have seen at this time Unicron eating a flesh planet.
True. Good point. Good point.
Now, here's another great shot. This water shot right here with Daniel. I mean, that's just amazing.
Because
water animation is always so hard. Now, supposedly the rumor, we see Beachcomber somewhere in this shot with Galvatron, and it doesn't make sense because I've never quite seen it. But a lot of people insist that Beachcomber is in this shot somewhere.
That's gruesome, watching the robots flailing to their death.
Yes.
You know, at this moment, I was wondering, as when I was a kid, going, is Spike going to survive? What's going to happen to those robots? I mean, and we see just what actually happens, and you almost breathe that sigh of relief. I mean, it was just that
mesmerizing at that time.
Yeah. I was just going to say, we're all thinking to ourselves, could they really kill Bumblebee?
Well, you know, it's an ongoing argument that I have with a friend of mine that I've known since high school, where he is firmly against the killing of any major character. Maybe Transformers the movie, you know, scarred him so deeply that's where he gets this from. But for instance, a show like The Walking Dead, he couldn't watch because people get iced all the time on that show. But I maintain that the whole reason that this ending works at all is because of the fact that you have seen characters that you know and love in some circumstances eat it earlier in the movie. You actually believe that the good guys can lose. Yeah. If Optimus is still alive at this point, you're like, yeah, okay, this is going to be the same thing. But Optimus dying, you know, Rawhide being gone, I'm sorry, Ironhide being gone, like that makes this whole ending work. It makes it all believable.
And the Junkions are obviously made of sterner stuff because they survived that. Now,
yeah, well,
one other interesting note, going back to that brief fight sequence between Hot Rod and Galvatron, if you notice, through that whole fight sequence, one of them is always transformed.
Oh, that's a good catch. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
As we get to Arise, Rodimus Prime.
Yes.
Have y'all noticed during this time the Matrix has, like, changed, like, different formats and everything? And I'm wondering if it was finally, when it finally touched Rodimus for the final time, if it finally conformed and let him able to open it up.
I think that's a good point.
That's an interesting theory.
You gotta admit, this is a cool scene right here.
Yes.
Throwing him through the wall. I mean, look,
and then the animation quality right here is as Rodimus is opening the Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
See, you look at it now.
I love the fact that they use the multi-cut moment that's so, you know, a staple of action movies of the era. You know, you're watching the same moment of time, but it's from two different angles, one right after the other.
And I love what they do here is Unicron is suffering from the Matrix, where he's in so much pain, he's literally ripping his own body apart.
Right.
And I love this. It's Hot Rod. No, not really.
Yeah.
And just a great voice acting direction where they actually make Rodimus' voice deeper than what it was as Hot Rod.
And there's the Space Winnebago.
Yep.
So wait a minute. Is that some sort of subtle comment that a Hot Rod goes from this awesome sports car when you're young and you're hanging out with your friends and you're just, you know, a couple of dudes going out on a fishing trip. And then when you get older, you're going to get a minivan. And even if you put racing stripes on it, there's no escaping what it really is. And it just means you've grown up and you've taken on responsibility. Am I reading a whole different level as an adult here right now that I shouldn't be looking into?
Well, the
death of Unicron, the head flying off, and then kaboom! Oh, I remember seeing that in the movie theater, and just there was a friend of mine. His name was Paul, who had tuned out by this point in the movie, and I remember myself and several of my other friends just staring at the screen in awe as to what had just happened.
And something I love now, as we're getting into the classic Till All Are One scene, and we're kicking into, right before we kick into the opening credits, I mean, we're seeing Cybertron beat up, but then this shot right here of Unicron's head in orbit, and you just realize, we're not done with this yet.
Yeah, and I will give them credit that in the, you know, in the following season when they travel back to Unicron's head, that was such a cool nod. But in that shot when his head's revolving around, I was actually, again, this was another thing that I became obsessed with drawing, was Cybertron on as a knight side. I thought was such a cool design that I wish we had seen it more often.
Yeah, no. I agree. And what I love too with the closing credits here, they actually put most of the voice actors from the show in some kind of credit with this film.
Now, here's a question for you, for anybody that can look at those credits and immediately recognize a very important Star Wars connection. Hats off to you, because there is an extremely important Star Wars connection in those credits. Everybody knows the Star Trek one, but there's a Star Wars one.
Really?
There is. Do you want me to give you the answer, or do you want me to make people work for it?
No, go ahead and give us the answer.
Clive Revel. He was the voice of the original Emperor in The Empire Strikes Back.
That's right. Right.
That's correct.
And he was in the extremely terrible film adaptation, Legend of Hell House. Or the book was called Hell House and the movie was called Legend of Hell House. Which I highly encourage anybody to see, because it's terrible, but it's a lot of fun. It's 1970s British horror.
Wasn't Clive Revel also in the Q episode of TNG where they were in Sherlock, where the cast was playing Robin Hood, the Merry Men, and he was the sheriff?
I do not remember. He may have been.
Oh, his name sounds familiar. I could be wrong on that.
Now, think about this. We're looking at, you know, we've got the storyboard artists, we've got the supervising animation director, we've got all of this stuff. I defy anybody, when you look at these credits go by, right? Compare the animation you just saw on this movie that is so great and true moments of animation brilliance, and how small, comparatively speaking, the crew is compared to the digital artists that work on something like Captain America Civil War. Civil War had like 40 minute long credits. I'm exaggerating, of course. And you know, but like this had a fraction of the people working on it, but produced this, you know, hand painted, drawn animation that's so gorgeous.
Yeah, no, and again, and I think for me, once we were done with the movie, because it was a good 6-7 months before we got season 3 of Transformers that takes place after the film, and it really started with that 5-part, The Five Faces of Darkness. And I remember when that finally hit, how heartbreaking it was to see how bad the animation was on that run.
Yeah. Now, do you think that the animation on that run is better / more money is spent on it if this movie makes more money?
Oh, I think so. I think if this movie makes more money, a lot of the Japanese Transformers series that have never been brought over here end up getting brought over here.
Okay, fair. I think that's fair.
I mean,
because if you remember the very last season, Rebirth, it was only 4 episodes.
Yeah, it was basically the Headmaster storyline. And the animation on that.
That short?
Yeah, it was basically, and it didn't air, it never actually aired, it aired one time, I believe.
Yeah.
Dolby Stereo.
Yeah.
Used Dolby. To be the gold standard for sound.
Yes. And of course, these are all fictional events, gentlemen, so sorry.
What? Wait, no, I thought this happened 11 years ago.
I thought I saw it on the news. But no, I mean, this movie, what's amazing to me about this movie is, I mean, this movie was meant to reset the toy line, introduce all these new characters. And I remember that, I believe it was the Christmas after this movie had come out. It was a Transformers Christmas at my house because I got so many of the new characters and that it was just, it was mind blowing to me. I'm like, wow, I got Ultra Magnus. I got Hot Rod. I got, Galvatron. I mean, it was crazy. And I even now when I look at the toys that came out from this film, because at that point they were using a lot more plastic in the figures. It was just like everything after the movie, it's like, okay, we've shot all our money on the movie. It didn't do as well as we have, so let's just pump out what we've got. And it just felt like there's such a drop off in quality, both in the animation style of the show and in the toys that were coming out after Transformers the movie.
I think it's a fair observation. Yeah.
I mean, I can
see. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and the perfect example I can think of is the Rodimus Prime figure. That thing was basically a stick with a trailer attachment to it.
You have a point there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was absolutely no articulation to Rodimus Prime. The Hot Rod figure had more articulation to it.
Yeah, he did.
Now, I have a question for you as we're wrapping up. Like, is there, in terms of Hot Rod and Rodimus Prime, did you ever find yourself in the unenviable position of having to defend your support for the character? Because I had a lot of friends that rejected Rodimus out of hand and still to this day do. And I've always been the one that's sort of like, I like him. You know, like there's nothing wrong with him. Like Rodimus technically is in, you know, a blink of the movie. But like, I like Hot Rod. Like I got a lot of people that I know that trash Hot Rod.
I personally like the Hot Rod character. Rodimus wasn't around long enough. I think more hatred of Hot Rod / Rodimus comes from season 3 because they wrote him so weak in season 3 as very questionable as the Autobot leader, full of doubt. You know, one of the best episodes was actually when he lost the Matrix and reverted back to Hot Rod.
Design-wise, are we sort of in agreement that that Hot Rod was a cooler design than Rodimus?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Okay. I think I might have given away my answer when I was talking about the whole, you know, trading in for a minivan when you want the sports car.
Well, now, here's the crazy thing. I think season 3 of Transformers actually was some of the more mature writing of the syndicated TV show itself, because it dealt with some pretty heavy topics. I mean, you had
I could go along with that. Sure.
I mean, you had a whole episode with Galvatron where he basically goes to an insane asylum planet.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this will lead into something that I know a lot of people have a problem with season 3, was you had the episode where they find the floating coffin of Autobot bodies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which, and you know, it's funny about that. Do you remember they went to that mausoleum?
Yeah, that's what, they were in that, it was basically a flying mausoleum where all these Autobots from that battle were buried.
But wasn't Brawn not listed as one of the casualties?
Well, there were several characters who were not listed as the casualties. Daniel goes through a list of about 5 or 6 characters, but I mean, he's naming, if I remember correctly, he even names off some characters we don't see die in the film.
Yeah.
But the basic idea was, except for Cliffjumper, Jazz, and Bumblebee, everybody else from the original series was wiped out.
Yeah, that's true, because I think we only see, was it Trax and Skids and a few other ones, Hoist.
Blaster was in
it. We don't see a lot of the other ones later.
Yeah, no, Blaster was around for a couple episodes, obviously, after. But basically, any of the Transformers that were Diaclone figures were killed off. Because that's the reason why that happened. They lost the license to those Diaclone figures.
Oh, that makes sense.
But we talk about that Mausoleum episode, and events of that episode actually lead into what was the season finale of season 3, which was the two- or three-part miniseries, The Return of Optimus Prime.
Yeah. Yeah, I will be the heretic in the bunch and say that The Return of Optimus Prime I thought was a giant cheat. I didn't like it then. I don't like it now. And I think that it's one of the first instances I can think of as a fan of creators caving to fan pressure. And like, there's a tremendous lesson that our generation could have learned, you know, at least the Transformers fans, of, you know, death is a part of life, and, you know, the people you love are going to go, and, you know, you need to accept that. But they took the cut, just like they did with Spock in Star Trek. They took the cop out and they said, hey, it's not permanent. That's fine. And just brought him back. And I just saw it. I thought it was such a cheat. I didn't like it. I still don't.
Well, you are not alone in that, because I felt that way too. What I did find funny, and let's see if you guys remember this. You remember how everybody was losing their minds over the Ultra Magnus figure, because basically the trailer was an Optimus Prime that fit into the Ultra Magnus armor?
Right, right.
So they pulled a little cheat in that three-part episode, because if you remember right, they covered Optimus in this special metal to keep him from being infected by this hate virus, and it turned him white. So just a little,
I remember that.
So just a little like, oh, well, now we have an excuse to play with this trailer part of Ultra Magnus. We've given them a story to use it for.
you know, it's very funny how, you know, the Ultra Magnus toy itself was a white Optimus Prime, but then you put the armor on him and he becomes Ultra Magnus in IDW. And not to give anything away, but it's I'm just gonna go spoilers. There is that is also armor as well in the IDW continuity, which I find is really, really cool.
Yeah,
and backstory to everything.
Yeah, I think that was a good tribute to the actual toy. Now, one of the things we saw in the film was the Quintessons. And what season 3 makes the Quintessons so essential to the Transformers backstory? What were your guys' feelings on that?
I was just I remember at the time just being happy that they found a reason to have the Quintessons come back. Because I've just always the character design is so unique and cool. So I was more than happy with it, and then. In terms of impact of the storyline, I think that Transformers, and especially Transformers the movie, came around when I was just getting old enough to really appreciate and desire more complex sorts of storylines. And that's what the Quintessons did, was they made the storyline a little more deep and interesting. And I really dug it.
Yeah, I gotta say that when I heard about how everything happens, everything is so well connected to it, I thought, you know, this is actually really cool, a really cool story. I mean, just it's not just a cartoon for 20 minutes, you know, and that's that. There's the writers themselves, for even for G.I. Joe and for Transformers, I mean, they really took the time and actually wrote a good story.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's where G.I. Joe and Transformers really especially slide together, because I think one of the things that Marvel really helped with was the aspect of creating that backstory for the Transformers. Because especially in G.I. Joe's case, in comparison, you had Larry Hama, who wrote all the bio cards for the Transformer, or for G.I. Joe, and they ended up using that same format to work for the Transformers, where they had a bio card for each character, and I think that really helped them set up the show and develop the characters more, so you had that continuity going.
Oh, absolutely. Like what we talked about with Wheelie. I mean, yeah, we see him in the movie the way he is, but if you read his backstory, he's there on that planet because his ship crashed and he's the only survivor. And so he's there with whatever going on.
Yeah. Now, we talk about it because really I think Transformers the movie was the last real true Transformers high mark for the 80s because of the decline of how the show was afterwards. And then to me, as far as the toy line and everything itself, really the nail in the coffin was that year where the Headmaster started coming out, and all of a sudden we've got all these little gimmicky Transformers. Because you look at how those toys were built, a lot more plasticky, and you have the gimmick of either Target Masters or Headmasters or Power Masters, where they're tied in with a humanoid character being part of the Transformer. Even in the storyline with that wrapped up and brought back the golden age of Cybertron at the end of the Headmasters arc, it just felt like everything was rushed, and it's just like, we just got to wrap this up. We don't care anymore.
Well, probably.
Yeah, it did seem that way. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah, the shift is probably. I think what made Transformers special and what we've been really talking about is that they cared about it, even though it was just a marketing vehicle. You had people in charge of it that were driving a real story behind it, and they weren't just treating it as we'll just knock this out really quick. But I think probably after the you see a change in in perspective of people come in who are just saying, yeah, okay, this is just to sell toys, who cares, and that's probably where the specialness leads, and where that sort of fly by night feel of the storylines comes in.
Yeah, agreed. And I just watching this again, it just brings back that joy of that little kid and brings me back to those memories of seeing it, sitting in the theater, watching this, and just being amazed and totally brought into this world that the movie created. And just getting lost in it for an hour and a half. And, seeing something that was so crucial to my childhood give me such a wide range of emotions through things I never thought I would see. Transformers dying, the depth of it. I mean, this movie definitely goes down to me as one of the more underrated movies that's out there because it holds up so well to this day.
Completely agree.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
So, well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for being part of this. This has been a lot of fun and definitely a great trip down memory lane. I'm going to ask you before we close out, though, can you tell us where people can find you on social media and podcasts, and let them know where you're at.
Well, you can find me. This is John. You can find me over as Kessel Junkie over on Twitter. And you can find me on a podcast on the Trek FM network called Stage 9, where we examine the work of Trek creators when they're not making Trek. And you can find me on a podcast called Aggressive Negotiations, which is over on the Nerd Party network. That's about Star Wars. And then I'm on a podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my pal Craig.
And then with me, you can find me on Twitter at Davis Grayson. And then I'm also on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's social grouping. If you want to actually hear all about everything that's going on with podcasting there. And I'm also on the Fandom Podcasting Network as one of the moderators over there. And I'm love to talk to anyone about all things geekiness.
Absolutely. And of course, this is Kyle, and you can find me at AKyleW on Twitter. You can find Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook with both our group page and our normal page. This has been the first episode of Couch Potato Theater. We've got a lot of fun with it. And gentlemen, at this point, Davis, you're part of the network. I don't know what insanity inspired you to accept the invitation, but we're very glad to have you. And John, it has been a blast, and I want you to know you're welcome back to sit in on to the couch potato anytime you feel like it.
Oh, well, thank you. I've had a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much, too.
Yeah, and like I said, it's been a blast, and I guess the only appropriate way to end this is till all are one. Gentlemen, Gentlemen, thank you so much. Everyone, this is just the start with Couch Potato Theater, and I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. So thank you again for listening, and go pop in the soundtrack to Transformers and let it take you back to those magical places. Good night, everybody. You got the touch. You got the power.